Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most awake, probably the fastest growing, could well be the largest segment of society. To those who have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, economic, and media institutions are universally corrupt, that they are all counterproductive, and that not one of them can be fixed. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 3 hours, is 877-300-7645. I'd like to begin today with something that has been lingering for a long time, and that is what transpired in the Ukraine with the downing of the Malaysian Airlines. Now, that's ancient history for many. It's an event that the United States pinned the blame on Putin, who clearly had absolutely nothing to do with it, and you'd have to be a complete ignoramus to believe the American indication that it was a plot coordinated and equipped by Putin to bring down the airplane. It now appears that that there is a witness that has actually seen what brought down the airplane. Hello, Larry. How are you today?
Well, I'm fine. I just thought I'd call in and take part today. So
I'm glad. So what do you think? First of all, what do you think that the likelihood was that Putin orchestrated the downing of the Malaysian airliner? It was certainly used to inflict sanction after sanction on Russia. It was the big tipping point in terms of the world issuing sanctions against Russia and condemning Putin. Do you think that there's any possibility that Putin orchestrated the downing of the Malaysian airliner?
No, I don't think so.
No. No, in fact, it would be it'd be so counterproductive for him that and it's so opposed to his nature, I would agree. It's 0% possible. That's what the United States proposed. Have you ever taken a look at any of the debris fields from that crash site?
No,
seen
I haven't.
Pictures? Yeah, there's a lot of pictures from the site. There's two pictures that are really interesting. One is that an individual still strapped to their seat is still wearing the oxygen mask that dropped in the passenger compartment, which means there had to be time from the depressurization of the aircraft for the mask to fall, to deploy, and then an opportunity for someone to put it on and before the airplane, the G-forces of a exploded airplane would have blown completely out of control. Have you ever seen a video of a missile hitting an aircraft?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have time to do anything. By the way,
the aircraft is not only destroyed, but the explosion of the aircraft is enormous when you light up the fuel in the wings on top of everything else. And what little did you know that the debris field of the airplane? You got pieces that are just shattered everywhere. It's kind of like the events of the Challenger breakup. The G-forces are so extreme that you have a missile strike in an aircraft or an explosion of fuel. Nobody is reaching up and you don't even know which way would be up and putting on an oxygen
mask. No, in the middle of an explosion, you're not going to know that. No,
yeah.
You're dead.
You're dead. Yeah. And you'd have no control of your arms anyway because the G-forces would be too extreme. The other thing, the pictures of the sighting of that aircraft, where you can see that there has been round holes penetrating the skin of the aircraft. One panel shows it's about 4 feet by 4 feet. It must show 100 holes in it, all of the same diameter, all round, all the same diameter. Does that sound like the shrapnel from a missile to you?
No.
Every hole round. No.
Nope.
Really. Nope. Sure.
I'd be ripped up. No.
Right. Yeah. And you've been trained in weapons. Do you think there's a possibility that somebody operating, well, the only weapon that could shoot a projectile that high would be a 50 caliber gun and to shoot that many, that'd be a 50 caliber machine gun. Do you think that somebody can shoot a 50 caliber machine gun 31,000 feet in the in the air and hit a target moving 600 miles an hour?
Absolutely not. No.
Yeah, impossible. So you look at the evidence and you'd think, you know, the Kiev regime was flying a lot of war planes over that area. They were routinely bombarding civilian urban centers, and so we know they were there because we know that in the weeks prior to the downing of that aircraft, a number of Ukrainian military aircraft had been downed while they were bombing civilian targets. So we knew they were there. We know they have them. The evidence certainly supports air-to-air interaction. It's the only way that you could shoot an aircraft in the air to leave that kind of pattern of holes would be from the gun on a on an aircraft, military aircraft. You know, I've flown aircraft for a long time. I've never been able to buy one that has guns on it. Military aircraft. And now the Russians say that there's a witness that is acknowledging as much. Do you think that if that is the case, and even if it's a case, which you know, I always thought the case was that the Kiev regime was flying so many bombing runs on Donetsk and Luhansk, and that the Russian rebels had been able to confiscate Ukrainian weaponry by taking over the army bases in the Donetsk area, that they brought it down accidentally, mistaking it for another warplane attempting to bomb them, which case you would pin the blame on the United States for starting that war. But, you know, do you think that the United States, the Obamanator, is going to apologize to Russia, reverse the consequence of all those sanctions now that the evidence no longer supports the American theory?
My guess is not. No, they go out, they trash whoever they trash for whatever political reason that is expedient at that moment, and then they never bring it up again if they're in the wrong. You know, I mean, that's just the way it is. It's, you use every given situation to advance your own political self and then act like it didn't even happen. Right?
Yep. Yeah, it's the we're going to create false scenarios and then hide the truth so that people believe the lies. And yet, the thing that I guess troubles me the most is not just about this particular episode. And this episode is part of a really important picture, the maneuvering of the United States into a role of massive deceiver and belligerent, because it's clear, based upon what's happened in the Ukraine. In fact, Russia said it yesterday. It said that the whole episode with Kiev, the initial riot, the gang taking over the popularly elected government, the Americans sending the NATO chief, CIA chief, army chief, vice president to Kiev, coming over with $25 billion worth of American money, and providing military intelligence to the Ukrainians to attack the Russians, that the entire purpose of this was a desire to have the Ukraine be part of NATO.
Imagine that, huh?
Wow. Yeah. That's the whole purpose, right from the beginning. And the Russians today said, you know, it is so obvious, we wonder why the rest of the world isn't condemning the United States for this plot that has left thousands of people dead, economies ruined, all because the United States thought that we could bring the Ukraine under the auspices of NATO. What advantage is that to anyone? The transfer of the Ukraine from neutral, which is what they were previously, to NATO.
Well, I guess it would make them feel a little more powerful. I have no idea. I really don't know what the big advantage is, other than there's money spent and
power grabs. Okay, let me ask you this question then, from this perspective. Do you know why NATO was created?
Yeah.
It was to offset the Warsaw Pact, right?
Right.
Right. Because the USSR was aggressive in terms of seizing territory. And so the West created NATO to be a Western European and North Atlantic opponent to the Soviet Union and their Warsaw Pact. That was the purpose of NATO. Does the Soviet Union exist anymore?
No, it doesn't. No.
Is there any nations in the Warsaw Pact that are acting belligerently to the West?
So NATO should be going away. I'm with you here.
Yeah. So what's the purpose of NATO anymore? I mean, NATO serves absolutely no purpose. Why not just disband it? And I think
to enrich a few. I mean, there's it serves its purpose, but it's not the purpose we're ever told. Very little out there. Yeah, very, very little out there really is out there for what we're told. I mean, let's face it. They have PR firms. They have a campaign. Somebody comes with an idea that, we can make a lot of money doing this. Well, let's sell it this way. And then that's how it's approached.
Yes.
Right?
Okay, this is from the Deputy Defense Minister, Antonov of Russia. He said NATO countries pushed Kiev to this counterproductive decision, trying to turn the Ukraine into a front line of confrontation with Russia. That is absolutely obvious. I don't think you can be an informed and rational person and come to any other conclusion that right from the get-go, the riots in Kiev, all the way to the Western support of the thugs that overpowered the properly elected government, to the offering of $25 billion from the International Monetary Fund, to the litany of war makers and spies who ended up on Kiev's doorstep, and all of the sanctions and rhetoric that followed. I don't think there's any other rational conclusion than this was the intended purpose. Talk about your shattering this. A gentleman I've known for a long time, he's a teacher on the East Coast, sent me an email this morning, and he said that he actually got two Facebook messages from coworkers, fellow teachers. One of them sent a Merry Christmas from America, and it had a picture of an American sniper. Got to, of course, always blend patriotism, militarism, and religion together in this country. The next one said, Merry Christmas Eve. May we all count our blessings today and stop and ask ourselves, what would Christ want for Christmas? So, Larry, what would you say to someone that said, what would Christ want for Christmas?
Oh, well, whatever you want to make up in your head, because Christ is an imaginary figure. There was a Hebrew Messiah, and he did not have a Greek or Roman name. He did not. He was not born, by the way, that day. Right. He existed.
By the way, and they're using Christ here as a name, because it doesn't say what would the Christ. So even though I agree with you that Yosha had a Hebrew title, and he had a
he didn't
Hebrew
have a last name.
God does not have a last name. He only has one name.
Yeah, matter of fact, that's a Roman invention, the whole last name thing, too. It's part of our legal system. And when they renamed their new Roman god at the Council of Nicaea, from what I read out of their encyclopedias, they used Jesus Krishna, Krishna being the Eastern sun god, that's San Christ in the classical, and to this day, the Eastern arches in the Catholic Church are called what? The San Christ, aren't they? You know, so I have a tendency to think that's where they got that from. I know you
well,
think
you
it's
know,
drugs, but
looking at the Greek text, the oldest Greek manuscripts use placeholders. And the placeholders are used just as they were in the Septuagint. We can't ever, should never look at anything out of context. If you want to understand why something was done, you have to look at the context. And so the original autographs, the oldest versions, I should say, we have of the writings in the so-called Christian New Testament, most of which, by the way, are trash, but the ones that might be considered credible is much of Montaigne, some of Yao Kanan, little bits of Mark, and Revelation, maybe Shimon Kefish's, Peter's two letters might be considered useful. The rest of it is trash. But in it, in the Greek text, and we know for certain that Matanya was written in Hebrew, and that between the Romans and the rabbis, they destroyed all of the Hebrew eyewitness accounts. And so all we have is a Greek translation of it. But in the Greek text, 100% of the Greek text from the first, second, and third century CE, and really through about the three-quarters of the way through the 4th century CE, you know, to around 375, 100% of the quote-unquote New Testament manuscripts, the codexes, use placeholders 100% of the time for Yahweh's name, for Yahusha's name, for their titles, without exception. Every page, 100% of the time. So you will never find the basis for Jesus or Christ or Lord written out on any page of any of the first, second, third, or most of the fourth century manuscripts.
Yeah, I've seen them. Yeah, they're just placeholders. And
right. Now, the history of the placeholders...
Because they couldn't, the Greeks couldn't hold the Greek couldn't hold the Hebrew Yod, amongst other things.
Yeah, there's the sounds in Yahweh's name cannot be replicated using the Greek alphabet. It's quite simple. Now, the basis of that, the history of doing that, is found in the Septuagint. When we look at the oldest copies of the Septuagint, and this, all the Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Hebrew Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And I want to dispel a myth right away, which is to infer that the Septuagint was written in 275 by 70 rabbinic scholars in Alexandria, and that when you're reading the Septuagint, you're reading a document that dates back to 275 BCE. The letter that supports that is a complete con job. It's as big a con, if not a bigger con, than the Jackie story in Rolling Stone magazine about the rape that did not occur at the University of Virginia. So we're going to return to this, because this is really important for people to know there is no Christ. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Since we are approaching Christmas, I guess this is Christmas Eve as we're broadcasting today. It's a holiday that, Larry, you and I will not only not celebrate, but openly and aggressively condemn, purely pagan, having nothing to do with God, in fact, an abomination to God. It is important, since it's called Christmas, for us to go back and investigate what can be known about this mythical name, Christ, and how it emerged. So if we turn back the pages on the oldest manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament, and I call it so-called Christian New Testament because there is no New Testament. And you're familiar with why I would say that. Correct, Larry?
Yahweh didn't create any religion, much less a new religion.
Correct.
But yeah,
and
yeah.
There's only one Testament. It's the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, or the is the total and complete testament of Yahweh. There is nothing more, and the concept of a New Testament comes from the very book that openly condemns the principal tradition of Christmas, which is the Christmas tree, Jeremiah, where Yahweh says that he's going to have a renewal of his covenant, but not with not a new one, and not with the Gentiles, and most certainly not with the church, but instead with Yehuda and with Yisrael. And that the renewal of his covenant is going to be done in such a way, accomplished in such a way, that there will be one distinction between it and the current covenant. So the current covenant is going to be renewed in such a way that there's one thing different. What is that one thing, Larry?
You won't have to study the Torah. It'll be made an intricate part of your being. He's going to write the Torah inside of the family. That's what he's going to do.
Yeah, you're not going to have to go try to find a copy of the Torah. Hope that you're reading the oldest, most accurate version of the Torah. You're not going to have to go and study the meaning of each of the words, and you're not going to have to grapple with the stems, the conjugations, and the moods. Yahweh's Torah is going to be written inside of everyone who is part of the reaffirmation of his covenant. Literally put inside of it. So how is it even remotely possible that there could be a New Testament based on this passage that negates the Torah, when in fact the only difference between the existing covenant and its renewal is Yahweh personally writing his Torah inside of us?
It's not possible, and the reason that he's writing the Torah inside of us is because there's those of us out there that are investigating every aspect of the Torah, and you know you're one of the most Torah observant people probably on the planet, whether you will say that or not. I'll say it. At least that's my opinion. And yet, you yourself said that you understand about 1/1,000,000th of the Torah. Can you imagine understanding 100% of the Torah?
Oh, I can't wait. But no, yeah, from my current perspective,
yeah, you're actually yearning for that moment.
Right, you can't wait. And by the way, we need to be very clear here that this your reference to observing the Torah is the same as David's comments regarding observing the Torah, the same as Yahweh's perspective on what it means to observe the Torah. The mythical concept of being Torah observant is doing everything the Torah says.
You cannot do everything the Torah says. There's no temple. I mean, it just cannot be done to that.
Right. You can't. So,
but you
are not inferring. You're not inferring, and I would not ever claim that I do what the Torah says more completely.
You're Torah obedient.
I'm not Torah obedient. I'm Torah observant.
You can't be. Right. It's impossible.
Torah observant means to closely examine and carefully consider the instructions, the guidance that is provided in the Torah. And so that is an extraordinarily easy thing to do, an extraordinarily beneficial thing to do. And when you do that, one of the things you come to realize is that there cannot be a Christian New Testament. There will never be a New Testament, much less a plan conveyed from God that negates any aspect of his Torah. And proof of that, and I want all of our listeners who think that there is a godly holiday called Christmas, who think that somehow this is a godly time that they should celebrate, that they're pleasing God when they observe Christmas, I think they should go to Jeremiah 31. You can read it in a English translation. You won't get all of the meaning. I would suggest that you go read it in introtogod.org. You'll get a much more accurate translation of it. But go read it and see who it's addressed to. Go read it and see what it says after we read that Yahweh is going to write his Torah inside of us. And by the way, if you see the word law, that's a religious copy of it. Torah does not mean law. It's Torah, and it means teaching and guidance and instruction. But the next statement that Yahweh makes regarding why he's putting his Torah inside of us, the benefit of him putting his Torah inside of us is really important. It's not well known, because once you get to, well, Yahweh's writing his Torah inside of us, that means that the whole concept of a Christian New Testament, all of Pauline Christianity, is negated by that concept. But you know what God actually says next? It's interesting. It's what he says next is, by doing that, there is no longer any deceit, no delusion. That humankind's tendency to deceive is negated.
Then yeah,
once the Torah is
written
inside of it, you can't fool people with religion. You can't fool people with politics. You know, once you have the Torah written inside of you, your perspective, your enlightenment, your education is so complete, becomes impossible for anyone to deceive you anymore. I think that's part of the purpose of the whole thing. And by the way, it's also interesting, Larry, before we move back to the Septuagint and the placeholders for the title Masayah, Yahusha as a name, for Yahweh as a name. One of the things that is kind of interesting about all of this is that there is a 0% possibility that Yahweh could have delineated his Torah as his plan, tell us that the Torah should never be added to, never should be diminished in any way, should never be negated, that it is the source of enlightenment for those who are open-minded, and it is the means for all time to resolve our sin. And then to have a man say, Paul, all of that is untrue. That God erred, that he was incompetent, that the Torah did not work, and therefore he has an entirely different plan. Why would you trust such a God?
I wouldn't. They take letters from a man, right? Mm-hmm. Put them in a book, and they use his historian, Luke, to back it up.
Yep.
They call it a New Testament, and they take the words of God, of Yahweh, throw them aside and call them out of vogue.
Yeah.
Well, why didn't you, your neighbor could have done that for you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's what you really want.
That's what you want. You know, what's interesting here is that there's a reason that Yahweh doesn't write his Torah inside of us right now. Free will.
Yeah, free will. He wants you to go understand it.
If you're not interested enough in knowing who Yahweh is and knowing what he's offering, of knowing how to capitalize on his invitation to be part of his family, if that is not a priority to you, then God doesn't want to spend his eternity with you. It's as simple as that. So rather than put it inside of you and just make it easy so that any dunderhead is going to be invited into heaven, making heaven like life here on earth, full of all sorts of morons, Yahweh has said, you're going to have to choose it. You're going to have to prioritize it. If it's not a priority to you, you are never going to get to know who he is and what he's offering. So it's appropriate that we have to seek him, that we have to invest the time and energy to come to know who he is and then listen to what he has to offer. So that's why the Torah is not written inside of us now. Back to the Septuagint. The earliest copies that we have of the Septuagint date to about 100 to 150 BCE. And in those earliest copies of the Septuagint, which is simply a Greek translation of the Hebrew text, and I got to be careful when I say simply, because Greek is a language is amongst the worst languages to properly convey the ideas that were expressed in Hebrew. It's a language way too infected with Greek philosophy, Greek religion, Greek politics, the Greek sense of superiority. Horrible language. So to convey the very concepts that Yahweh was conveying in Hebrew, it's an inadequate language and a corrupting language to do that. But nonetheless, it was a Greek translation of the Hebrew. When in the Septuagint, when the translator of the Septuagint came to Yahweh's name and Yahusha's name in the oldest copies of the Septuagint, those that date to around 150 BCE, do you know what they did?
No, I don't.
Yeah, they wrote them in Hebrew. They realized they could not write them in Greek, and so they wrote them in Hebrew. And so the oldest copies of the Septuagint are Greek translations of the words, but Hebrew spellings of the names. And that's true of every copy of the Septuagint that we can find, dating prior to about 50 CE. And then around 50 CE, we begin to see that the Hebrew spelling, using Hebrew letters to convey the Hebrew names, we see them replaced by Greek placeholders, where Greek letters are used, but it's typically two Greek letters with capitalized with a line over them to say, this represents the name. We're not going to try to spell out the name because we can't do it. It's a Hebrew name. You really need to turn to the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms to see this name and understand what it means. And so we're not going to try to change the name to a Greek name. We're just going to put placeholders there that direct you to the name. And that was the case with every copy of the Septuagint through about the second or third century. That's what the Christian New Testament replicates. Recognizing all of this, and recognizing, Larry, that there is not a single place in any 1st, 2nd, 3rd, or early 4th century manuscript of any book or any letter in the so-called Christian New Testament where Christo, which is a claim to be the basis of Christ, is written out. How does anyone in their right mind justify it?
I have no idea. I guess they don't care what they call the creator of the universe. They really don't care.
So man is so important that man can change his name or give him a name. It does not just change his name. Christ doesn't change his name. It's a complete and utter fabrication, and that's okay. That. The God who revealed himself and revealed his name 7,000 times in his Torah, Prophets, and Psalms and said, I only have one name and I only want to be called one name throughout all of time, that it's okay to provide an entirely different name.
You and I both know why he said that, that his name was so important. Yes. We know that the family decided to lose all things Yah in Babylon. Right. So Yahweh became my Lord, Adonai.
Yes.
And now with the Christians, Yahusha, meaning Yahweh saves, defining himself and his mission, becomes Jesus Christ. Yes. And on and on. There are fabrications built on these falsehoods. And he knew that. That's why he said the love of the name would be part of being adopted into the covenant. Yeah, simple.
If you don't love his name, you don't know his name, you don't know him. If you don't know his name, you do not know him. That's just all there is to it. And if you do love his name, you are not going to accept the religions that have grown out of false names.
They did everything to lose Yah. Matan Yahu becomes Matthew. Yahu Kanan becomes John. You know, Zachar Yah becomes Zechariah. Yasha Yahu becomes Isaiah. Masiah becomes HaMasiach. If you've got one foot in two different religions, which is what it seems to me that the Messianic Jews have.
And Yahusha, meaning Yahweh says, becomes Jesus.
Yeah, or Yeshua, which has meaning.
Correct. What's interesting is that even the corrupt Romans, and Romans historians during this period were really pretty bad, but there are a number of accounts of Yahusha by Roman historians. And the Roman historians tell us that the name that was the title that was applied to him in Greek was Christus, not Christos. And somebody might say, "Oh, what's the big deal, Christus, Christos? I mean, who cares?" Well, they're entirely different words. Christos is based on Chrysos, which means to apply drugs. It's the reason why the RX, the Rokai, in Chrysos is used in front of every pharmacy in the world. That Rokai, RX that you see in pharmacies, it's all from Chrysos. It's about the application of drugs. That's what the word meant. So to be a Christian would be one who is drugged. The Christian Christ is one who applies drugs. Christus, entirely different word. Christus means a useful implement. Someone that is doing good and beneficial service is a Christus. It happens to be, you know, if you take the Yahweh connotation away from Masayah and just deal with a Maaseh, which is the Hebrew word for implement, doing productive work, that's not such a bad translation. But all of that was thrown away. And they came up with Christ and Christian and Christmas, all based upon corruptions, replacement, copy edits. It's nowhere to be found. No one was named Christ. The term was never used by anyone in the first, second, or third century CE. It is part of the mythos of Christianity that was all discerned, all formulated to take people away from knowing Yahweh. Take them away from his Torah, so that they could convince them to participate in a new religion.